Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles Megan Miller. The Westchester soprano is a rising star in the opera world. We explore an innovative exhibition at the Penn Museum. The look and content of Imagine Africa will evolve over the coming year through visitor and local community feedback. And Susan Lewis takes us to an exhibition at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia of the insect illustrations of a world-renowned entomologist. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Beautiful women with big voices can be difficult to come by in the opera world. So when the Bard Summerscape Festival in Annandale-on-Hudson in New York needed one for the regional stage premiere of Richard Strauss's Des Lieb der Danae, the solution was a soprano from Westchester, PA named Megan Miller. Known mostly for regional opera performances until 2 years ago when she re-emerged with a larger voice and a specialty in the emotionally complicated roles of Strauss. Now the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports on an unlikely career resurgence for a local singer with a bright future.
Singers sometimes search for years to find the right niche. Soprano Megan Miller needed time for her voice to catch up with her brain. Though the first years of her career tended towards lighter weight roles and the personas that go with them, she now commands the kind of higher magnitude voice that inspired Richard Strauss to write complex characters who begin Act One in one emotional place and arrive in Act Three quite changed. Miller has already sung some of them and is learning even more during her multi-performance run in Des Lieb der Danae, or The Loves of Danae.
The past couple years have been really exciting for me. I'm in the middle of role debuts and house debuts. And there are moments when I wonder about my wisdom in accepting all of these things. But at the same time, this project in particular was very interesting to me. I love Strauss, and this is the repertoire that I've always wanted to be singing. And I appreciate the way that Strauss allows a woman to think on stage. And to make that the center of an evening? Very attractive.
Young Philadelphia singers have come to follow some pretty specific career patterns. They start at Settlement Music School or Temple, maybe landing at the Curtis Institute, or getting their final finish at Astral Artists or the Academy of Vocal Arts. Since Megan Miller did none of those things, it's no wonder that her Westchester-based parents, her father's a retired chemist who once worked for NASA, were rather suspicious of a career in opera.
I was a high achiever academically, and to be really fair to them, I probably had a new idea about what I was going to do with my life every 2 months. Like, I was going to be a writer, I was going to be a painter, a graphic designer, I was going to be the president. I wanted to be Katie Couric. I had so many dreams. And when I started talking about opera, they started thinking, like, that would be a waste of her intellectual ability, which actually it's not at all. You know, I was making all-state choir in Delaware, but how would that ever guarantee that I'd be able to support myself in a worldwide market of opera?
She went to great schools, but not the sort that routinely cultivate operatic singing, even though she ended up having more encouragement than had she gone to more competitive places such as AVA, the Academy of Vocal Arts.
AVA was never on my radar. I actually didn't know what AVA was when I was applying for schools. And I was also coming from Washington and Lee University, Lexington, Virginia. Wonderful, wonderful school, and I got a lot of performance experience there. They did an opera for me. They saw that I was talented. They didn't even have a music major at that time. I was supposed to be a journalism major when I went. And I premiered, like, students' songs, and I did my first full recital there. Crazy.
She ended up at the Juilliard School, won some competition prizes along the way, and was thought to have a Joan Sutherland-type voice. And though La Traviata came her way in Princeton, a junior Sutherland is expected to go towards bel canto roles, most of which are vocally complicated, but are more like archetypes than fully rounded characters. Her reemergence in Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos at the Vienna Volksoper 2 years ago went so well that it opened doors to many more unlikely roles, such as Minnie in Puccini's Fanciulla del West, which she sang at Teatro Massimo in Palermo. Later this year, she'll graduate to the Vienna State Opera for the title role in Strauss's Daphne. These days, she studies one new role while singing another.
If I start listening to other recordings and disagreeing with their choices, I know that I'm almost ready. Which makes it hard to work with conductors sometimes.
Onward to The Loves of Danae, which for many is Strauss's biggest unknown opera. Almost all of his seldom heard late pieces have been dusted off in recent years in the greater New York area, and though none have been hailed as masterpieces, they've gained many new admirers, just as many remained baffled and bemused by Danae. He wrote the opera in 1940, but by the time the premiere was scheduled 4 years later, World War II was in its final stages and all the theaters were shut down. Not until 1952, after the composer died, did Danae receive a proper opening. The aging Strauss had become fascinated with gods of antiquity, and in this opera, tried to have some fun with them, even if few were likely to get all the jokes. Even more curiously, the composer seemed to be sending up Kurt Weill's Threepenny Opera in the opening scene, where Danae's father is pursued by creditors. Miller's character was updated to be a sort of Paris Hilton type, a high-profile heiress, in a production designed by Raphael Vignoli, also known for designing something called the Kimmel Center. This Danae took place in Manhattan and the deserts of Dubai, and thanks to a kiss from King Midas, Megan Miller turns to gold.
I think the piece is hilarious. There is so much satire, and I think we hear kind of spoofs that Strauss is writing into the piece, because he thought this was going to be his last opera, and he didn't think it was going to be performed while he was around. And I think he just threw everything in there with no worries about how it would be perceived or even having to answer for it.
Even if she never sings the role again, or whether she gets hired by other companies because of it, Miller did something she believed in, something that used all that she had to offer.
We have to seek what's true. Otherwise, what are we doing? We're not going to become wealthy people doing this, so we have to do it for a reason.
Well, who knows? At least on stage in Danae, Miller is showered with gold.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Megan Miller will make her debut at the Vienna State Opera, singing the title role in Strauss's Daphne in December. In March, she returns to Philadelphia for two performances with Lyricfest.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Penn Museum has over 60,000 African artifacts, 42,000 of which are from Egypt. The museum is now working to reinterpret this extensive collection in ways it hopes will especially engage the local expatriate African and African-American communities in the storytelling process. Imagine Africa with the Penn Museum is a year-long project exploring community perspectives on the continent that gave birth to humankind. An exhibition of about 50 objects is accompanied by numerous message boards on which visitors are encouraged to comment on what the show is missing and what else they'd like to know about various objects. The various sections of the exhibition have been organized by themes, including art, healing, fashion, power, and religion. Over the next year, the museum will also, through its website and programming, engage in discussions with the regional community. The museum's director of exhibits, Kate Quinn, believes this interactive approach will result in richer exhibitions and a more dynamic relationship with the public, and may be a model for the future for other galleries in the museum.
2 years ago, we started this process of trying to get a sense of what and how we could reinterpret the African gallery here at the Penn Museum, which has been in place since 1985, and it was really a hodgepodge of information that went together. It didn't have a strong vision, so we knew that there are many different ways and many, many stories that we could tell with the objects and with our collection, but what's the best way, and how can we teach in the best way? So we decided to open it up to the community and get a sense of what our neighbors want to see and maybe start a relationship with them that maybe has been struggling or didn't exist before. So essentially what we did here is to take the idea of a comment card and blow it up all over the gallery. So tell us about anything. You have the opportunity to comment on everything that you see, and we hope that you will. And we'll continue a conversation with the visitors through the next 3 years or so until we get to a point where we'll be able to fully reopen an African gallery based on their comments. So it's more of a collaboration than a dictatorship, I suppose, that we're not going to just tell you what we know. We're going to ask you what you'd like to know, and then we can frame our content around that and tell you some great stories in the meantime.
And I'm guessing that you're getting many comments from members of the African American community, but I think a subtext of this exhibition is that we're all from Africa at some point.
Yeah, Africa is humanity's first home, so that's something that I'd love people to walk away with. We have a large text panel when you first walk in that's giving you three main points, and that Africa is humanity's first home, Egypt is in Africa, and Africa is a continent, it's not a country. When we were doing some initial front-end evaluations with the public and just asking, how do you imagine Africa? What is Africa to you? Give us some keywords or just some images. Just tell us what you think. It was a lot of safari and a lot of tribal arts and a lot of things that Africa is, but Africa is so much more, and it's so much more vibrant, and there's so many, there's modernity there are cities there, and it's just like here, and people are amazed at that fact. So trying to pull a lot of the contemporary issues that Africa is dealing with, along with our very colonial collection, and the expertise that we have here on staff and within the university community, is something that we're trying to figure out the best way to move forward with a permanent gallery. How can we tell community stories and more contemporary stories through our collection, which is older and dated, but we can do it. We just need to see if that's something that people are interested in knowing more about. What kinds of stories do you want to know?
But in terms of the scale of the place, it is a continent like all of the other great continents of wildly divergent cultures, language, and in much the same way that nobody would ever think about doing an exhibition called Europe.
Yes.
And expect there to be a generic European. Yeah. How hard was it to get away from the idea that many people in the West have a generic idea of what an African is?
Well, that's what we're trying to do with this, because through the front-end evaluations, we did learn that people have a generalized view. So instead of just going specifically into very pointed themes and just saying, okay, now we're going to tell you about five different cultures and how they feel about religion, we have to start broad. We have to ask people how you imagine Africa, what is it to you, and get them to think about it and to put their minds in that place. And then step by step, we'll go more into detail with what we can tell, because you can't really ask people to go into a place and see a room full of objects and tell us what they want to know, because there's no context for them to understand what we could tell you. So if we can engage in a conversation and tell you that there are many stories we could tell, this is Africa, there are so many languages, so many cultures, so many things that come from Africa, and here's a sense of it. Here's a little taste of the things that we could do. We're missing things. We know that. We're limited by our collection. We're limited by our expertise on staff. But we can do something about that if there are. We have a whole year for you to tell us what you want to know. So if everyone is drawn to religions in Africa and they want to know specifically about certain aspects of one religion in particular, the Yoruba or something, we can dive more into that, because we know there's an interest there. And we know we can. We just don't know that people are interested. So this hopefully will be able to draw from the public where the interest levels are and how people like to learn, which another core aspect of this is that it's highly interactive. We have a lot of interactivity that's happening. There's AV. There's a lot of images. It's not just objects and text. So, and is that a way, are these ways that people like to learn? Are people drawn to the AV? Do they love seeing these videos, or do they really just want to see objects and text? So what we've done is put comment cards all over and tell us if you hate the fact that we put graphics everywhere, which someone already did. That's great. Then we can start a conversation, and what we'll do is put it on the website or have some more conversations with the public to say, you know, okay, so someone said this. Do you agree? Should we be doing more of this? Or, you know, and see what a consensus is. It doesn't necessarily mean that any one thing is going to win. It's not a contest, but it is something that's going to strongly inform us as we're moving forward with a new permanent gallery.
The exhibition is broken down into several themed areas.
Yeah.
What was the starting point for those? I mean, we have religion, we have art, we have...
We have eight themes that we went through, and it's very basic. It's art, power, which is great kingdoms, healing methods. We talk about the diaspora, art, adornment. They have evocative names, so we decided that a lot of people were having difficulty with the word adornment. What does that mean? And we're like, oh, well, you know what? It's kind of fashion. Oh, well, fashion's cool. I know fashion. I can get into that. So all of a sudden, if we were changing names of things, it was an in for people to start understanding. So they have more evocative names than adornment. It's imagine fashion. Imagine power. And power is all about great kingdoms and politics in Africa. Imagine beauty.
I'm sorry, but how did the traditional academics in this institution react to this simplifying the terminology?
Everyone who's seen what we've done and have gone through and vetted all of the texts that we wrote have been very excited about the idea, and particularly for students, that students will have a different way of accessing this information. But really, this experiment as we have it out here, this year-long survey, is for the academic community as well. We're hoping that everyone comes in and tells us, which is why we're trying to pair up the comment cards with some basic demographic information. If people are comfortable with leaving that, then we'll have a sense of who is expecting to see what, and we can play up those audiences in different ways when we get to the permanent gallery. But the conversation is for everyone.
How much did you have to learn about Africa when you started this, and then what surprises did you meet along the way as you put the exhibition together?
Oh, an extraordinary amount. That's what I love most about my job, though. I think I can travel the world in a day here. We have a strong collection. We have over 20,000 pieces, and with our Egyptian collection, Egypt is in Africa, 42,000 more pieces. So our collection is vast. And for me, it was just getting a sense of, to start looking at some of the objects, and, you know, what is this thing, and how do certain cultures deal with rites of passage? And what does it mean when you're, you know, putting certain objects next to each other, and how people live in different cultures. And I don't know that there was any one specific thing that surprised me. The music did when we started to go through, but that was more contemporary anyway, that we're trying to give people a sense of what Africa sounds like, and that it's not that different from here. They have jazz, they have rap, they have the same kind of things that we do, which so many people so far have been completely surprised by, and myself included, and I was kind of embarrassed by that. It just sounds like I know this song and I've heard these kinds of things, but it was surprising to me in that way. But overall, I think there's just so much more depth to Africa. And in some of our initial conversations with the communities, we found that a lot of people really wanted to know more about the contemporary issues. They wanted us to tell them more about the AIDS epidemic. They wanted to know about Darfur and famine and wars. Whereas when we talked to African people, they were afraid that we're going to tell you too much. Don't tell them all about the bad things. There's so much more to this continent, to my country, that you should be talking about that is fantastic, and it's brilliant, and it's vibrant, and it's wonderful, and maybe we can talk about that. So it's been a struggle to find the right balance in what we can put out there to let people know that we are able to tell some contemporary stories, but that's not what Africa's all about.
Would success for this, because of the collaborative nature of this is a collaboration between you and your public, so to speak, would success, I don't know, a year down the road, look like... Well, would it be a success to find that you completely missed out on something?
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm hoping that a success for me for this exhibition would be that the walls are covered and that people are emailing me constantly about what we should be doing, and that I can't sleep at night because there are so many comments coming in, and that people are so engaged with this and they have so many informed comments to give to us that my inbox is full.
And going forward, is this a way that you would like to take on all exhibitions in the future?
I would love it. I think it would be great just to establish more conversations with the public about everything that we have here. I think we're going to see how this goes first, but this model is something that we could use for other galleries in the institution as we move forward with renovating our permanent galleries throughout the museum. It's a nice way of having people become engaged with, well, hopefully become engaged with what we're doing and how we do it. This would be a dream of mine, is for people to walk around in University City saying, this is my museum, in the same way you say, my Philadelphia Eagles, this is my museum, and that they feel that truly, and they believe that it's their museum.
Director of Exhibits, Kate Quinn. Imagine Africa with the Penn Museum runs through September 2012. Artists may depict the splendor of the natural environment by creating panoramic seascapes or sweeping landscapes with magnificent mountains or wooded forests with light filtering through canopies of leaves. Now an exhibition at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia explores the beauty of nature found on a much smaller scale through the drawings and watercolours of one of its own scientists. WRTI's Susan Lewis met with the Academy's curator of entomology, the artist Dan Otte.
Set to the sound of crickets chirping, just over 30 paintings and drawings hang on the walls of an Academy gallery. In one, the body of a beetle looks almost like a painted shell. Two symmetrical pale yellow wing covers decorated by over a dozen irregular black spots, each side the mirror image of the other. Red eyes shine in its black head. Two light brown antennae extend like a curious wispy mustache. In another work, three long-legged grasshoppers look poised to leap. Each body part is rendered in precise and colorful detail, from bulbous compound eyes to jointed legs to wings, brought to life with greens and reds, whites and browns, textures and highlights. Curator of entomology Dan Oddy will draw a tiny insect larger, but otherwise represents them as they exist in nature.
I try to draw them as I see them, except when they're dead specimens and they've been in the collection for a long time and they've lost their colors. So I try to draw them with their original live colors.
Academy of Natural Sciences President George Gephardt says Oddy is in constant search for new species and adding specimens to the collection.
The fact that he has the talent to capture them artistically is such a bonus.
Gephardt says Oddy is working in the tradition of famous naturalists like John James Audubon, who was a member of the Academy.
His goal was to discover and to document every species of bird in North America. His art brought it to life, and Dan Oddy has done it again today.
Some of the illustrations I did, I was writing a paper on horned beetles, and I wanted some pictures showing beetles actually fighting. And there are two basically different kinds of horns that are used by beetles. The ones where they use their mandibles, and then the other one where they use two projections, one coming off the shoulders and another one off the head. But they fight in a similar fashion, and they compete for females. And if another male comes along, the point is to grab him, lift him up, and throw him off the branch.
This exhibition is a small fraction of Oddy's art. Acting director of exhibits, Jennifer Sanchi, was faced with selecting from among thousands of works, from landscapes and portraits to images of trains, mammals, and insects in a variety of media.
I really had no idea until I went up and saw all of his work spread out on an enormous table. He's not just a bug scientist, which he is. He has an incredible range of artistic skills.
Sanchi and her team decided to focus on illustrations of insects, the nuts and bolts, she says, of Oddy's scientific work identifying species.
They may be scientific illustrations meant to communicate information about the body of the insect, but they're undeniably beautiful. They're bright, colorful, very large, moving images.
Drawing and painting facilitates scientific analysis, says Oddy, in a way that photography cannot.
Well, drawings are aesthetically more pleasing, and also you have more control over the position of limbs and so on. A photograph, especially of a dried insect, isn't terribly appealing. It gives you a lot of information, but it's more difficult to, with photographs, is to have direct comparisons.
Oddy has been making art since he was a child, growing up in Africa, where he started drawing mammals. Over the course of his more than 40-year career as a scientist, he's described more than 1,500 new insects from around the world. He specializes in grasshoppers, which can be identified by their physical features, and crickets, which often cannot.
With grasshoppers, I don't pay too much attention on behavior. But with crickets, you need to know the songs.
The songs? Turns out, cricket species can look almost identical structurally and anatomically, but each species makes its own song. One called Riley's tree cricket is common in the western United States.
That's the one you hear in movies.
Each cricket tune is a mating song made by males with their forewings to attract females.
The way they do it is to move one wing underneath the other, and on the underside of the top wing there's a little file, and on the leading edge of the underwing there's a scraper. And so what they do when they close the wing, it scrapes across this almost like you'd put your thumb across a comb, and then they can repeat that many times.
In any given area, there may be as many as 20 different species all singing at once, making a symphony, or maybe a big choral work, of sound. Picking out those individual voices can be tricky. Oddy recalls one occasion in Hawaii.
We started hearing these crickets, and we said, okay, there's one species. And then we listened a little more. No, there's two species. No, there's three. No, there's four. And then we made this recording.
Once the songs are recorded, a computer can separate the sounds by frequencies or merely slow down the speed.
So what we discovered was that this one species makes many different rhythms. And this is a case of two males, and they're interacting with one another. One male is putting his pulse right in between another male's pulses.
Slowing down the sound also helps identify other insects. This recording of crickets and katydids from Borneo is played here 30% slower than the original.
There's actually two katydids in there. The kew, kew was one, and the other one was that ch-ch-ch-ch, that non-musical sound that was in there.
Today, the Earth can seem small, and the natural environment deceptively knowable, with little left to explore. But Dan Oddy and Academy President George Gephardt say there is still a world of creatures waiting for discovery.
It's harder to discover new mammals or new birds. On the other hand, new insects, new aquatic creatures, new plants happens all the time. Hundreds of species being discovered a year.
There's 12,800 known species of grasshoppers and about 5,000 species of crickets. And there's a vast number of species that need to be discovered yet. Crickets especially. I have a feeling that we know maybe 5%. 5,000 might come to 5% of the fauna that actually exists.
These days, using his computer, Dan Oddy is working on painting the places where he's traveled and collected. To the casual viewer, they look like sweeping landscapes of African plains, mountains in Hawaii, uncut forests in Pennsylvania. To Dan Oddy, they are teeming with life, with diverse creatures, some delicate and beautiful, others simply singing their song.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Dual Nature, Science Illustrations of Dan Oddy, is at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia through December 4th. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.